then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely croon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's the 8th day of May, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Right, we're going to kick off with a quick note from the old sod. Now, some of you may have seen in the news that Jerry Adams has been arrested in Belfast, and since it occurs to me that not all of you had the benefit of 5 years' residence in the Emerald Isle back in the 1980s like I did, you might not know who that is. Now, Jerry Adams is the prime public spokesman for the Provisional Republican Movement in Ireland, under their legal name of Sinn Féin, and no, that's not the same kind of Republicans we have here, more's the pity, otherwise known as the IRA. Adams was the main Provo media man, what counted when I was over there in the 80s. He was a well-known public figure who was legally banned from the airwaves in the Republic under Section 31 of the Broadcasting Code. So any Irish person who wanted to hear him speak had to tune in to BBC Northern Ireland or Channel 4, which gives you an idea of how effective the Dublin government's attempt to silence him was. He is now 65 years old and sitting in four or five government bodies on both sides of the border and drawing multiple government salaries, which is how politicians retire over there. I think Ian Paisley once held the record. He was drawing six simultaneous salaries as, let's see if I got this right, a Westminster MP, a Stormont MP, a Euro MP, a Belfast City Councilman, an Antrim County Councilman, and as moderator of his own little Presbyterian sect, something like that. I must say from the pictures of him that I've seen on the net, Jerry Adams has aged quite well. He can afford it now. He's come a long way from the H block. Anyway, in what appears to me to be a pretty clear violation of the amnesty attached to the Good Friday Agreement, Adams was arrested by the British, or rather by the Protestant Northern Irish, and at the time that I'm speaking now on Monday morning, he's still being held in Belfast by the PSNI, in other words, by the RUC. And don't let's get into Irish acronyms, or I'll be here until the cows come home. Actually, let me check the internet on that. Nope, he was released after 4 days, although he can still be picked up again and charged any time they want. Adams was quote-unquote questioned about an IRA murder back in 1972, that's 42 years ago, when he was 23 years old. Now, is this starting to remind you guys of something? Now, the victim was some woman in the Divis Flats who was accused of being an informer for the British, which she may or may not have been. Her family deny it, and the Brits, of course, deny it. But by now, that situation over there is so encrusted with decades of self-serving lies, black propaganda, disinformation from both sides, rumor and conjecture, urban legendary, and just plain crap that it is quite simply impossible to tell at this distance in time. Northern Ireland in 1972 was quite simply a different world, as is often the case in most places after 42 years. Now, I have no brief at all for the Provisionals personally. My few personal encounters with them when I was over there were all negative. For our British listeners, yes, 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 1,000 times, yes, I know that they are communists. Although, from what I saw, their Marxism consisted mostly of a lot of regurgitated hippy-dippy jargon from the 60s, and in the late 1960s, the true Marxists in the movement actually split with them and became the official wing of the IRA, and we will not get into all that because I do want to keep this podcast down to its usual 1 hour in length, more or less. Now, can we take all that backstory as read, okay? I'm speaking of the provos as the last remaining white practitioners of any kind of genuine revolutionary politics in the world. Or at least they were in my day, regardless of what one thought of their Che Guevara-like babblings on occasion. It's kind of startling to think of Jerry Adams as being 65 years old now, but I suppose he is. Now, there are two important things to note here. The first is that, as I said, this act on the part of the British and the Northern Irish government is in clear violation of the amnesty for the IRA and other combatants that they themselves agreed to, and which was an integral part of the Good Friday Agreement of 16 years ago. Now, the whole idea at the time was forgive and forget, for those of you who remember that period. Put simply, the word of the British government or any Zionist government is worthless. No Zionist institution of any kind will keep its sworn word or change its behavior unless they are compelled to do so through direct action for change, or else the credible threat of direct action for change. Basically, the British establishment feels that enough water has passed under the bridge, and they're now dealing with a bunch of old men in their 60s and 70s who were foolish enough to give up their guns and weapons in exchange for the promise of government checks and pensions and a few petty political offices off to the side of actual power, which did, however, come with chauffeured limousines. Now, the British paid them their government perks and bennies so long as it was convenient. A few crumbs off the table of the big feast of true wealth and power that the Zionists control. Now the whole situation has gone soft enough for them to be able to indulge in a little revenge and make an example out of Jerry Adams to the effect that no one ever successfully defies Zion. They could still decide to charge Adams with that 1972 hit. I think this preliminary detention was just a trial balloon, testing the waters, so to speak, to see what kind of reaction it would provoke, to see if they could get away with breaking their word and violating their own treaty. So far, the only reaction has been words from the equally aging and decrepit Martin McGuinness, which means Adams still could face these charges in direct violation of the peace treaty if the Brits and the Orangemen think that the Northern Catholics have gone too soft with 16 years of computer games and telly and good living to go to the effort of smuggling in guns and slapping some gelignite together in their bathtub and fighting again. Secondly, a lot of the so-called evidence upon which the RUC, excuse me, the new inclusive and oh-so-politically-correct PSNI, anyway, part of the evidence that they're basing this 42-year-old murder case on comes from a series of so-called historical tapes recorded over the past 10 years or so by Boston College in Massachusetts, something they called the Belfast Project. These are the reminiscences of a lot of old IRA and UVF veterans, many of whom have since died of old age, and so can no longer be called to testify or be cross-examined. One of the conditions upon which these men talked about their past and basically said things, frankly, I don't think they should have, was that these recordings would be kept secret until after the death of everyone concerned. And they were given firm assurances to that effect by these people at Boston College, these academic historians or whatever they were, that this would be the case. I suppose that these old lads from the Falls Road and the Shankill can be excused for letting their guard down in their dotage and telling tales out of school. I mean, hell, Grandpa Simpson always likes to tell stories about how things were. Any of you who listen to this program know that. After all, these men thought that the war was over, right? Didn't the British promise them that it was all over? Didn't they agree to the peace of Good Friday? Plus, I imagine those cute little girls from Boston College who were doing the interviewing looked really sweet and brought along a bottle of Bushmills or a few pints of Guinness for them. Now, the RUC, the PSNI, took Boston College to court in the United States, demanding access to the tapes. And last year, a U.S. court ordered the scholarly egghead types who had them to hand over the tapes, which order these people obeyed like little lambs. knowing full well that they were violating their own sworn word of honor to these men, and that probably people were going to die, because they were unable to stiffen their spines and keep their word, like real men do. A revolutionary cannot trust anyone other than those who have walked through the fire with him. And a revolution is never complete until the previous order, the previously existing power structure, has been completely dismantled and removed. As long as the tyrant's government remains even partially in power, however weakened and however bound by treaties or armistices or whatever, and as long as the tyrant still has armed men at his command who will continue to do harm to others at his order, then no one is safe. Never. And the revolutionaries have won nothing. The Provisional IRA may be about to find that out the hard way. Okay, a little early for a music break, and I know I played this song just a couple of months ago, but I think it's appropriate.
We remember back in time, the year of 69. You lead your dogs of war into our street. We could not stand idly by and let our families die. We fought you back and joined the IRA. So stuff your fucking crown, we Irish won't lie down and give away our guns to foreign land. No Semtex, not our guns, will you ever get from us. You can stick your decommission up your ass. Well, you murdered 14 young men and you'll do the same again. Decommission you will never, ever see. As long as we have men like the famous fighting men. Yes, those famous fighting men from Crosswoodland. So stop your fucking frown, we Irish won't let down and give away our guns to foreign land. No Semtex, not our guns, will you ever get from us. You can stick a decommission up your ass. They were Ireland's bravest men. We will not forget the ones who fought and died. Decommission you can see will never ever be, cause the IRA will always be around. So stop your fucking crown, we Irish won't lay down and give away our guns to foreign land. No Semtex, not our guns, will you ever get from us. You can tell the RUC, those black bastards from Dunkey. They will never march down Gervahi Road. Never, never! If you want to make a fight, we will stand up for our right. You can take your fucking march and give us peace. So stop your fucking crown, we Irish won't let down and give away our guns to foreign land. No Semtex, not our guns, will you ever get from us. You can stick a decommission up your ass. Now tremble, you're an ass, if you think that it will last. Six counties are under tyranny. You can tell we Tony Blair and Momo the Monkey Care. They can stick the decommission up their ass. So stop your fucking crown, we Irish won't lay down and give away our guns to foreign land. No Semtex, not our guns, will you ever get from us. You can stick your decommission up your ass. So stop your fucking crown, we Irish won't lay down and give away our guns to foreign land. No Semtex.
Yes, the IRA will always be around.
Are we gonna do what they say can't be done? We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm eastbound just like old Bandit Run. Keep your foot hard on the pedal, son, never mind them brakes.
Greeting, comrades. This is the trucker again. Just giving you some more tips and tricks and thoughts from the road. Winter is just about over out here in the Rocky Mountain states. You get an occasional snowstorm coming through. And I just got done with a really lonely, boring trip. Nice and scenic, though, from Las Vegas. Took the extraterrestrial highway and came out through Oregon to deliver by Portland. And for all you comrades that are going to be coming from back east, more populated areas, there are some desolate stretches out here, so plan your trip accordingly. It's like on the movie Wild Hogs, when it's next gas 200 miles, sometimes they're not kidding. It's hundreds of miles between towns, and if you don't have enough fuel, you're going to be stranded. And a lot of these places out here don't have cell phone service, no towers, so just be wary. Also, this is stolen from another podcast. Instead of renting a U-Haul or Ryder truck or whatever, you might want to check with local churches to see if they're going to be selling off a bus that's in reasonable roadworthy condition. You could take the seats out of it and load your gear in that. That way you're not having to pay mileage and all that. You might be able to get the bus for a song, and you still have a vehicle afterwards to store stuff in or move stuff around to another location or resell it to somebody else. Just a thought. Hope to see all your moving vehicles on your way out here soon. Yeah, right now it's raining out here in Washington. I'm trying to get some work done around the house before I have to take off tomorrow to pick up a load of seafood and head for Iowa. All right, comrades, travel safe. Hope to see you out here soon. This is the trucker signing off.
Eastbound and down, loaded up and trucking. Are we going to do what they say can't be done? We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm eastbound up, watch old Bandit Run.
Comrades, tonight we're going to be finishing up the last of our Eggers books for a while, because I'm going to be going into the De Silva books next, and a couple of those I'm going to be enjoying on my new Kindle. Some of these things in Eggers are spaced repetition, like Harold often talks about, so I'll just talk about some of the concepts that are more emphasized in this book than some of the others. Eggers talks about poverty and sacrifice, and he talks about people in power. It's a good idea for them to resist the temptation of property, because Eggers doesn't want these individuals to be influenced by personal gain. In this book, Eggers talks a great deal about selfless service, and he talks about how the strong demand life only. Now, one of the most interesting things about this book is a dialogue that Eggers gives us at the end of the book. And it really encapsulates these ideas. The first question in this dialogue is about prayer. How does one pray? What does one pray for? Eggers tells us that the young often pray because they want to impress their parents or some authority. But Eggers says that when we grow up, we should seek the solitude of our hearts and go within to consult the law. And we have to realize that the deed becomes a religious service. So the realization of our duty, he says, becomes a demand that lets us judge ourselves and does not let our conscience slacken or even fall asleep. So then the response to this is, I will strive to become hard and clear like a crystal. I will seek until I have found the law within myself in order to be able to serve the community as a whole person. Now then there is the question of, will things go well for me? But Eggers tells us he knows that the knowledge will bring fruit, but he does not know who will one day harvest this fruit. He's not interested in personal gain, but he says the meaning of the strong life is that it is effective. So then the response is, I will not for the sake of pleasure betray duty, which binds me to the struggle for the future. And then the question is asked, what is honor? Eggers tells us that honor is the affirmation of your duty, which you have learned from the demand that the law has arisen within you. The warrior's honor is the purity of the deed. It is the incorruptibility of his will. And so then the liturgy response to that is, I will not seek honor in the radiance of the loud praise from a mass that is distant from the law. Rather, in the unbending will to myself, shape the yearning for freedom that burns within me, within the community. And then the question becomes, what is joy? And Eggers has an interesting response for this. He says that joy is a superior play of the strong with danger. And then the liturgical response is, I want, in order to one day become joyful, to victoriously wage the fight for the preservation of my essence. And then the question becomes, how do the strong view life? And life means recognizing the law and oneself standing in order. And, of course, by law, Eggers means an inner law, a natural law, a sort of dharmic law. So we're told, whoever holds his life dear, just as one loves project and work, just as one loves community, folk, and honor, just as one loves freedom and yearning, that person will not lose life. So I think it is a saying that that which is given is not lost is relevant here. And so the liturgical response to this is, I want to lead my life alert, conscious, and becoming. I never want to be satisfied with a part, rather to totally fulfill the law, so that I serve the community as a whole person. I do not want an existence of renunciation. I want to lead a life of the law. But then this is clarified when a question is further asked, what is the formula of the law? We're told once again that to live bravely means to consciously fulfill the law. We're told that weakness is not being able to fulfill the law. Evilness is not wanting to fulfill it. A lie is glorifying the powers that hide the law. And ruling is the application of the law. And so it is promised, or it is responded, that I will watch out for all doctrines that want to hide the law from me. So, to clarify, even though we're told it's not about renunciation, we're also told that we must be careful of doctrines that hide the law. We're also told, I much prefer to be lonely and to serve the law than to walk in the mass of those whose yearning for salvation and flight from the law will turn them into herd animals. And then, finally, there is the question of, how do the strong face death? And we're told that the strong accept death calmly. He sees here as well just the law. His essence is intertwined with the law, so that he does not become fearful when the law is obscured to him in death. So essentially it's just that you come one with the law and therefore death is inconsequential to you. Death reminds us of our need to fulfill the law, our need for the fulfillment of duty. Then the response is, thought of death shall not be a horror for me, but rather a stimulus. I know death is not the goal of sin, rather the working of the law in which I live and die. I hope that I will die courageously in my duty and know that only the person who has fulfilled his law dies a blessed death. So a very dark view of life in this, as we've been getting from all the Kirk Eggers work. Now, I understand that Kirk Eggers writes as an idealist. He's talking about the ideal, and you might say, how often in life is this really the case? For example, those who are successful in leadership, they might find themselves doing very well, and they might succumb to the temptation of property in some cases. And that may be so, but Eggers is giving us an ideal follow, and therefore writes very inspirational books. That's the point. It's to inspire. And so, yes, it's an ideal. And I know that life is often less perfect than the ideal that he speaks of. And that, I suppose, produces sadness. But that doesn't mean that ideals should not be striven for. So I'll soon be finishing up my first book on Kindle, and that's going to be a very challenging and really kind of refreshing. It's a very new take, or the way, let's put it this way, the way it's written by an insider who really knows what points to bring up. So I'm very excited about next week's book, The Foundations of the 21st Century. So I hope you enjoyed tonight's presentation. So, until next week, good night and hail victory, comrades.
One of the aspects of being a media personality, even a minor one like me, is that people keep sending me weird stuff they want to play on the show. This is a group called Rapus 8. I have no idea who they are or what their racial outlook is, although judging from their CD cover, which lists a lot of our white nationalist websites, they do appear to be white racial nationalists of some sort. This first cut of theirs seems to be a kind of white rap song, but I always encourage us to perform and record and distribute our own creative media. So let's give it a spin and see what you think. This is Rapus 8.
Bill of Rights, Hayden, Synagogue of Satan, Bail Rich Banksters, Puppeteer Maiden, Tribes on TV, Mordecai Levy, Monkey See Baiting, War Monger Pharisees, Marxist Agenda, Printed Paper Lendas, Military Whores for your Mideast Wars, Murders in Gaza, Viva La Raza, Two-Party Tyranny, Puppeted Democracy, Media Moguls, Media Moguls, Media Moguls always kill us like that. Genocide artists, herders of lemmings, the future is dimming. Emasculation, vanishing nations, re-encyclopedia and mind-sucking media to dismiss every obvious conspiracy. If anyone exposes the Zionist agenda, lock them away in the bright light of day. Two-party tyranny, puppeted democracy, media moguls. Media moguls, media moguls always kill us like that. You want the truth, better read David Duke to laugh at it all. YouTube Ramsey Hall. stand by your side. Bob Whitaker is fine. Read Kevin McDonald, comprehend tribal models. There's Hillary Clinton to be a Zion minion. Really think Jesus would murder Palestinians? Style thinking minds in a willing time. Two-party tyranny, puppeteer democracy. Media moguls, media moguls. Media moguls always kill us like that.
Before we go any further, I'd like to make a quick comment on something Andy Donner said last week on this show. He was referring to the late Pastor Robert Miles, and he referred to Miles as a Christian identity minister, which technically he was, of course. However, my impression was always that CI was just the vehicle that Bob chose for his racial work, and he did it well. But that actual religious dogma of any kind always sat rather lightly on him. I think Bob's own true worldview was best expressed in an interview that he did with somebody on the old Race and Reason show back in the 1980s. I can't remember who this was exactly. It was a long time ago, but he asked Pastor Miles a question, something like, "Okay, I get that you're a Christian identity guy, but tell me, do you actually believe all that stuff?" Or words to that effect. And Bob responded, "I believe in God, and I believe in the white race. That's all that's necessary." Indeed. Okay, now comes the grim and the serious part of the podcast, which I will try to keep short and then close out with a little more of our codger clatch from several weeks ago. Last week, I stated on this show that in the light of the grotesque Frasier-Glenn Miller episode, and the fact that this is just the latest in a long line of excruciating embarrassments for our kind, it was and is my considered opinion that we in the white nationalist movement need to sit down and have a long and serious rethink about the role that V-bulletin boards play in our wee little subculture, especially Stormfront and VNN, with a view towards ending our participation in those boards, because the risks and the drawbacks have come significantly to outweigh the advantages. Now, apparently Don Black and some other internet personalities, all anonymous of course, except for Black himself, took exception to this, and the result was a long diatribe of abusive vituperation on one of the board's podcasts from Black and the others, directed against me. I don't know what was said. I don't listen to Goat Dancers or read Goat Dancers' posts. The way that I usually find out about these things is when all kinds of people all over the internet email me breathlessly to tell me all about what some anonymous internet handle said about me on some bulletin board or blog or on the comments section of some blog, so forth and so on. Now, that's what happened this time. I'm not going to bother to listen to it, but I've heard enough of this kind of doo-doo in the past, so I can pretty much tell what it was like. Let me guess, apparently I'm just the most howable and wicked person in the whole wide world, so forth and so on. Look, guys, I get that this kind of inside baseball stuff is not exactly what you want to hear on this show, but you have to understand that our tiny little community has a number of serious problems. Most of them revolving around the problem, which is our weak, immature, and generally piss-poor character. And not just our own tiny movement, but all of us, all white people. I used to think that all this goo-boo and goat dancing crap was peculiar to our own little slice of life, but it's not. It's a white thing. 3 years at Decision One down in Texas taught me that. All white people born after 1970 or so are more or less cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. Basically, the Jews have succeeded in destroying the whole concept of normal, and all white people below a certain age are at least a little bit nuts, if only from growing up in a completely unnatural world, with nothing but this media and the Jewish entertainment industry as a source of information. They say that darkness is the complete absence of light. Well, light of any kind is now virtually completely missing from American life, so we can't really blame young white people for not understanding that what they do and they feel and they think is completely wrong. Now, who was there to teach them any different? Now, getting back to the subject of these bulletin boards, specifically Stormfront and VNN, don't take my word for it. Go there and surf for a while, by all means, but try to look at them with new eyes. Learn to think, not to feel. Learn to read things like these internet posts for actual content, not for entertainment or cuteness or validation of your own opinions. And never mind whether they make you laugh or whether they're clever or whether you agree with them or not. What do they actually say? And to what end is all this of any practical use in the real world? Now, after you've surfed for a while and looked at the threads, some of which will be, well, you'll see. Anyway, I want you to tell me exactly what good all of this ranting and raving does for the 14 words in the long run. Name me one single jot, one single iota of change that all of this jawjacking has accomplished. You can't, because 20 years of it has accomplished nothing. What exactly has come of all this vast flow of wordage for the past 20 years in Stormfront's case and the past 12 years in VNN's case? That's all I ask. Think about what, if anything, all of this sound and fury and frenetic pounding on the keyboards has actually produced in the real world outside the computer screen. Not much. One of the comments I got last week after I spoke out about this was a guy who said something to the effect of, "When I discovered Stormfront, I thought it was the greatest thing since sliced bread. And then all of a sudden, I turned around, it was 10 years later, and I realized that I hadn't accomplished anything at all during that 10 years. I think Don Black has hosted a few dinners in rented motel banquet rooms in South Florida down through the years under various false names, and that's it. I can't even think offhand of anyone who can honestly say that they have physically met another white racial nationalist off Stormfront. Now, our own little NF email contact list has only been going for a month, and as a result, we've already had 2 physical meetings between white people who were previously unknown to one another. Now, VNN, to my recollection, has staged 1 public activity in Knoxville, Tennessee about 10 years ago, wherein Alex Linder got himself arrested, apparently deliberately through back-sassing a cop. He paid a forfeiture fine at the police station, and he's been riding on that one contrived bust to make himself out as a martyr and a man of action ever since. I think a few years ago they published 3 or 4 issues of a tabloid newspaper, but they had to stop because Glenn Miller was editor and he couldn't meet the deadline because he was always drunk. Now, to give him at least some credit, Alex Linder does in fact seem finally to understand that his attempt for the past 10 years to rehabilitate Glenn Miller and jam him down everybody else's throat was an unmitigated disaster and a world-class cock-up. He has removed the discussion thread on Miller, and I'm told he's in the process of deleting Miller's several thousand posts under the name of Rounder. Looks like Alex is going to try the old 1984 down the memory hole unperson trick. Another few weeks, and no one will know that Miller was ever there. Well, good luck to Alex, but I don't think it's going to fly. Too many people are going to remember. Look, guys, for the sake of whatever posterity our race may have left, we have to start asking ourselves the hard questions now, the right questions. Given the track record of government and NGO monitoring, bizarre behavior, posters, many of whom are clearly mentally and emotionally disturbed, moderators who appear equally disturbed and some of whom appear to have hidden agendas, do men who have made such colossal lapses in judgment deserve any further attention or investment of time and energy and money on our part? When the impending crisis is the most dangerous it has ever been, and we are now literally looking at extinction within the next 20 years. There. I've asked the question for you. Never say I don't lead. Now you have to answer it. And here's some more codger clatch.
Part of it, in the old days, if they came and took your stuff, you just packed the wagon and head a little farther west.
Mm-hmm.
Or you'd get in a ship, you know, for $10, you could get in the hold of a ship and go a little farther west.
Right.
So You know, nowadays, if they take your stuff, you're pretty well screwed. There's nowhere to go. There's no safety valve, so to speak.
I suppose that's one way that possibly the pioneer ethic, if you want to call it that, works against us. Right. Because our American habit has always been, if we didn't like it where we were, you're right, we just packed up our gear, started heading west. It's ironic, that's what I'm asking people to do right now. I'm telling you people, if you don't like it, pack up your gear and head northwest, but we appear to have lost even that instinct. But we don't have a history in this country of confronting our problems. There was always this limitless land to the westwards, and if things got a bit irritating in North Carolina or Tennessee or Pennsylvania, wherever, we just packed up the wagon, we headed west.
Yeah, that's true.
Good thing, though.
Oh, not a whole lot. I was thinking about what you were saying for the past few days, and I remember seeing something on television, Alastair Cook, I think it was, and other people, my father's generation, in the day, would travel across country in Model Ts and Model As before there was an interstate highway system, when tires wouldn't last very long, so they'd carry a whole bunch of extra wheels and tires in the back of their car because they knew they were going to need them for the trip. And a lot of the trip was over dirt roads. Now, of course, that was a whole lot better than the pioneers with the Conestoga wagons. But the point is, where is that spirit of adventure, that willingness to take a few risks? We seem like such pussies compared to my father's generation.
We are.
They would do these things, and they consider them adventures and fun. You know, two guys, friends, would go cross country that way in a
Route 66, yeah.
Well, it was before Route 66. Yeah. Route 66 still was kind of like the modern era, but I'm talking about Model Ts and Model As before most of the roads were dirt.
That was during a time when that kind of mobility was fairly new. But nowadays, the attitude is, why bother to get in the car and drive across country? You know what you're going to see, more interstates, more strip malls. Why not just sit home and stare into an electronic screen? And that's the attitude we've developed.
I constantly hear people, they're always talking about the latest reality show. And it's like nobody does anything anymore. They just sit home and watch somebody else do it on TV.
That's what I was talking about earlier, Jersey Shore. Charles here has never seen Jersey Shore.
Neither have I.
Good for you. Actually, I have not seen it. I guess it's sort of my duty as a fearless whatever to kind of keep up with cultural trends, so I know what it is. I've seen a few clips of it on YouTube. I'm familiar with the whole ambiance, and so that in that sense. But just to be clear, folks, I do not watch reality shows. I don't have TV at all. I do not have cable. I haven't had for years.
Does this actually take place on the New Jersey Shore?
It's about six or eight young wastrels of both sexes who spend the summer sitting on the Jersey Shore in some kind of rented beach house, and about all their little escapades. And they've got, basically, they're just, although they call them Guidos because they're all Italian, except for one called Snooki, who claims to be Italian. She was raised by Italians, but she's actually a Chilean Indian who was adopted. Geez. I'm not joking. And they all have stupid names like Snooki and JWoww and The Situation and I don't know what else. But it is one of the most moronic things you can possibly imagine.
Well, that explains why I've never seen it, because I've seen the real Jersey Shore. I'm not interested in watching it on TV.
Right. Anyway, so there are all these other reality shows. I don't know if they're still doing it on TV. It used to be that they were filling up all the airtime with reality shows because they were so cheap to make. But in any case, just for the record, no, I do not watch television. I don't have cable TV. There's no point in paying $100 a month to see crap like Chris Matthews. And anything that's worth seeing on TV, you can eventually find on the internet, or you'll get through Netflix or something like that. You don't have to pay money for this gibberish, but most people do. They live off it.
By the way, I want to follow up on what I said earlier. The people who crossed the prairies in the Conestoga wagons had a saying, "The cowards never left and the weaklings died on the way." Mm-hmm. Now, we don't have a problem with people dying on the way here, but we do have a problem with people not leaving.
Yeah, right. Well, okay, I bitch every week about people not packing their gear and coming up here to the Northwest. It is happening in the sense that every week I do get queries from people who are intelligent. They seem to be serious. They are taking the project of migration seriously. They tell me, look, this is going to take some time. It's not just because I have to find a job and everything in the Northwest. It's that we have a lot to liquidate here. There is one young couple right now I am sort of counseling, if you want to call it that. I've been in communication with both the husband and the wife. There is no question in my mind that they are genuinely committed to coming to the Northwest, but they have a problem which is not uncommon, and that is that they have elderly relatives who are dependent on them, and their problem is, as much as they want to come here and make a life here for themselves and their children, what do they do with the old folks? Do they sit there and leave them behind in a situation where, frankly, they will eventually end up in a nursing home surrounded by niggers and Filipinos and Nigerian orderlies who will cut their throats for their IVs and things like that? And this is a very real concern. It's not like I'm unsympathetic, and I just tell them, okay, look, you're going to have to assess what is best in the long run for yourself, for your family, including both your children and your elderly relatives. If there is any way that you can bring them with you, great. We can help you with that as much as we can, finding your local contacts, setting you up with local care providers, etc. But as cruel and as cynical as this sounds, I say, look, you've got to make a decision. How long are you yourselves going to remain where you are, which in their case is a very niggerized area of the country? And how bad is it going to get? What happens if between now and then, while you are quite frankly, let's be honest, waiting for the old folks to kick off, what happens if between now and then your son or your daughter is badly hurt by niggers in some way? And I'd say, look, I can't make this decision for you. You have to weigh all these factors. But I tell people like that, and I'll tell you, if you're in that situation right now, I'll tell you the same thing. We need you here. The race needs you here. This is not because Harold is forming some little cult up here in Washington and he wants you to come and sing Om or anything like that. Your race needs you. History needs you. Needs you here. And again, I know how cruel this sounds, but at times you have just got to bite the bullet.
Well, I'd like to speak to that. Actually, I wouldn't leave him behind. That'd be a death sentence. I'd load him in the car and bring him with you, because I'm telling you, we've got room up most of the area in the Northwest. We've got plenty of room. The social service systems aren't overstressed. There's plenty of programs, especially for the elderly. Used to like to tell people that where I live, the homeless shelter is the equivalent of a 2-star hotel anywhere else. No, really. I mean, families and single women get their own room with their own private telephone line. I mean, it's unbelievable. This is the homeless shelter.
Well, people need to understand, the Northwest is arguably, I think definitely, the nicest remaining place in the United States to live. And I think the Canadian Northwest is much nicer and much safer and much whiter than, say, Ontario. So it's not as if we're asking you to move to a wild, trackless wilderness. There are facilities here. Anything that you need by way of goods, services, facilities, you can find here. You're not going to have to stop and build a log cabin like your ancestors did. What we're asking you to do, and yes, it's complex, it can be worrisome, it can be aggravating, packing up your stuff and selling your stuff at yard sales and putting your house on the market and cleaning the place and trying to find someplace on this end, which we'll help you with as much as we can. Yes, it's a bitch. I understand that. Moving is a very stressful experience in this society. But again, think about how the first settlers came here walking all the way from St. Joseph, Missouri, behind a wagon that was drawn by mules or oxen, and nothing at all waiting for them on the other end. I
mean, they had it good. My ancestors, they didn't have enough money for wagons and oxen. They built two-wheeled carts and basically loaded what little possessions they had and their children into the carts and drug the carts across the Great Plains themselves. And the trail is littered with the graves of their kids. But they did it because they knew they were going to a better, they were going to have a chance to build something better.
A lot of it, I think, was not only the seeking economic opportunity, but again, in those days, in the 19th century, our race had a spirit of what they used to call manifest destiny. They believed that it was God's will that the white Anglo-Saxon race would fill this continent from sea to shining sea, and they believed that they were part of a historic process. It was like almost like they were impelled to come out here, and that's what we lack. I keep trying to think of some way to instill that spirit in our people once again, and so far I'm not having too much success, but again, I want to emphasize it's not like I'm just totally sitting here talking to myself. I am getting responses, and slowly but surely we are building a community here.
One of the advantages that the Northwest has over most of the rest of the country is better economics, and I think that the economic collapse which is occurring is going to get very severe in the not-too-distant future. And when that happens, we will have more people coming here. And what I want to say is, beat the rush. Come early. Yeah. Get the available jobs that you can get within 2 weeks of arrival instead of coming in with a mob after all the low-hanging fruit has been taken, and you're going to have to really try hard to find a way to support yourself.
Yeah, I agree with that totally. Where I live, the crash never happened. When they were actually building tent cities in these little burbs around Seattle for the middle-class people that they foreclosed on their houses, it never happened out in the rural Northwest, and you know, the smaller towns. In fact, all of Montana, I mean, we never saw it at all there. Mm-hmm. The housing prices didn't drop at all. And it's a couple of things. The Northwest, only place in the country where they actually store food. There's plenty of room. There's wild game. Most of it's farmland and mining and timber and stuff like that, which will always be a demand for. So this is really, just on a practical basis, all politics aside, this is about the best place in the world to live as far as opportunity goes. Right.
This is Marie Osmond and Dan Seals.
Mountains in your eyes. Oh.
I recently got an email from a guy named Edward. Dear HAC, I hate to be pessimistic, but I personally don't believe that this kike-controlled government will permit any area of the country to become white again, one way or the other. Well, this is another fairly standard naysay that we run into a lot. The objection to Northwest independence in a nation of our own is that Zog will not permit it. The implication, which all too many of us buy into, is that the Judeo-liberal system is all-powerful. It sees all, knows all, can do all with a single lift of its putrid finger, and that accordingly we are restricted in our efforts to whatever the established power structure will, in its gracious condescension, permit us to do. First off, I can't recall a single successful revolutionary movement in the past 100 years that asked permission of the established order whether it wished to be overthrown or not. Can you? Now, this is a serious response. It has to do with our mindset. We must get out of this idea that we can only do what we are allowed to do by an all-powerful Jewish system. We are white men, and we can do whatever the hell we want. Now, if we decide that we are going to establish our own country for white people in the Pacific Northwest, then by God, that's what we're going to do, and we will not be asking any kikes permission to do so. Of course we will never get permission from the Jews to take away their power. What people who bring up this naysay are really telling us, what all naysayers basically tell us, stripped of their specious verbiage, is that it's all hopeless. The white race is doomed. Doomed, I tell you, is doomed. There's no point in struggling against the inevitable. We all need to give up, as these people have given up. Accept our own deaths with dignity, and meanwhile get back into the comfort zone, i.e. go back to posting crap on internet groups and comment sections of blogs that no one reads, and mailing each other depressing news clippings. Now, this is a second thing you need to bear in mind about naysayers. They have no alternative plan, because there isn't any. Their alternative plans, if any, stripped down, involve vague references to educating white people to the problem. In other words, endless words instead of deeds. They want us to continue to do the same thing that we have been doing for the past 50 years, which amounts to a bunch of sad old men mailing news clippings to one another. Anything else might make Zog mad and get them into trouble. Someone might actually come knocking on their door, which to most alleged white nationalists is the ultimate horror. All this talk about people actually moving to the Northwest must be silenced before the man comes knocking on their door, and all of a sudden it's no longer a computer game. Third, Zog is not all-powerful and omnipotent. Even the Jews are no longer what they used to be back in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. Their control is not absolute. Now look at some of those Jew jokes on The Simpsons and South Parks. Okay, that's hardly a pogrom, but I can tell you that as recently as 20 years ago, some of the things we occasionally see on TV would never have seen the light of day, and their authors would have disappeared. Fritz Hollings may have waited until the end of his career to denounce the Jews, but he did. Things are being said and written and published in mainstream media now that would have been unthinkable up until very recently. The Iraq and Afghan wars cracked the facade badly, and people are thinking forbidden thoughts and saying forbidden things. Jewish control is slipping and will one day fail. It always does. Historically, the Jews always overreach themselves. We are dealing with a corrupt bureaucracy, incompetent, dazed, quavering with senility, sick inside and divided against itself. Now, don't believe me? Look at the complete cock-up that was Zog's war against Iraq. It was supposed to be over in 3 months, according to neocon projections in March of 2003, and the red, white, and blue was supposed to be gallantly streaming over Tehran and Damascus as we prepared for the final seizure of the Saudi oil fields to make the world safe for Israel. Instead, it degenerated into the greatest American military disaster since Vietnam. The United States government can't even whoop poorly armed ragheads or Muslim hillbillies in Afghanistan. They're such stumblebums and military incompetents. Any regime that can make a cock-up of this monumental proportion is not omnipotent, all-seeing, and all-powerful. Zog is not firmly in control. It is asleep at the switch. And always remember the most important lesson of Iraq and Afghanistan. The United States can be militarily defeated by people who have the courage of their convictions and who are willing to put something on the table. The United States got its ass whooped by barefoot brown men with an AK-47 and a few magazines and a few homemade fertilizer bombs. The mighty Marines and Strikers and Green Berets and high-tech toys of death and the drones and the computers can be beaten by men of any race who are armed with plain, simple physical courage. The Iraqis and the Pathans are willing to die for their freedom. And the Americans are mercenaries who are not willing to die to take it away from them. Given that equation, Xenophon's comment about an army being stronger in soul comes into play. It's that simple. Oh, America will put all kinds of lipstick on the pig in the coming years, just like they tried and failed to disguise the fact that they lost in Vietnam. But let's face it, the Iraqis won, and the Afghans are about to win. Now, my novels are just that, fiction. But yes, we could beat the bastards as well if ever we discovered any remaining hair on our ass. Now, the examples of United States incompetence, corruption, sloth, and stupidity are so numerous that I can't get into them here. But for our purposes, let me point out that something similar to what we hope to achieve in the Northwest has already been achieved in Eastern Europe and in the Soviet Union during the 1980s and 1990s, when the once mighty Jewish Soviet Empire collapsed. As W.B. Yeats once wrote, things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Lithuania, Estonia, Poland, the Ukraine, these are now no longer communist, and in some of these countries, people of our way of thinking have more freedom of speech and thought than we do in the rest of the world, and yes, I know what's going on in the Ukraine right now. Putin is trying to put the old Soviet Empire back together. And in many respects, I wish him well, but you see what I'm saying here. When I was growing up, I never thought that I would live to see the Iron Curtain fall. It did. I never thought that I would live to see Israel fall, and there is a chance that that may happen before I die. Guys, anything is possible. Nothing is chiseled in stone. America is not exceptional. America is not immune to the laws of human history and human failings. Soviet Russia went down and broke up. Yugoslavia went down and broke up. A similar situation will arise here, and the United States will break up. It is a historical inevitability. We have to be ready and waiting for that event to make sure that the white man gets a piece of the pie here in the Northwest. But our time is up now, so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha and Aban. Freedom.
Oh, what glorious pride and sorrow fill the name of 98. Yet my thought it still is beating heart.